class today?
No, no, there is no class.
Your teachers know you guys are here and they're cool with it?
Yeah. Our teachers brought us here today.
For what? What are you, guys protesting? Are you testifying? Or?
You know, I don't really know. I guess we're protesting today.
I'm trying to stop whatever this dude is doing.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast for February 23rd, 2011. You know, not everybody gets to learn how to make a sound and convincing, reasoned argument to back up a cause or a conclusion, as demonstrated by these poor students in Wisconsin who have been lured into attending their teacher protests, even though they apparently have no idea why, with the benefit of skipping school. And look, if you can find something better to do than high school, I'm in your corner, for sure. But, you know, taking the day off to go be used essentially as a prop for people who want to continue to use violence so they don't have to pay into their own pensions, I would say that sitting in the classroom is probably a better use of your time than that. But I teach this SAT class. Class is 10 hours. I divide it into three parts: writing, math, and critical reading. Sometimes I make audio recordings of these classes, usually for my own use and review, but I do tell all the students, and I make sure I have their consent, that some of the audio might wind up on the internet. So I was recording this one because it was going to be a math class, and I was thinking I might be able to get a couple of good 2-3 minute clips of math demonstrations, problems that occur frequently on the SAT, so I could put a snip of that up on the website, and people could get a good idea of what goes on in this class. And of course, here I'm talking about the tutoring company's website, not the schoolsucksproject.com website. But I had blocked out the first half hour of the class to do a review of the previous class where we talked about primarily persuasive writing. I had asked or suggested that between the first class and the second class, which you're going to hear a clip from today, that students try to take a sample essay, and I had provided all of them with practice tests, take a sample essay and you know, try to write it and bring it in next time, and we'll take the first half hour of the class to review, to answer any questions, clear up any problems that people might have had with this process. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I don't know, nobody had time during their busy school and, you know, sports weeks to do this, so it left this first half hour of the class open. And I decided to use the time for review, but one of the students pulled out a pretty interesting essay question that I decided was worth, you know, a little rant from me. The question was, is the purpose of education to change the world? Now, in the previous class, I had talked about the whole pyramid of persuasion, how you build a base with facts and you work your way up towards a conclusion. I think, from my own experience working with students in this class and, you know, with other writing projects not related to the SAT, most people see the thesis as the starting point in the whole writing process. And I would say it's probably closer to the middle, because the thesis is essentially a conclusion that is made after facts are considered and examined. And I think a lot of times, especially on this SAT, because it's timed and, you know, people are kind of working against the ticking clock, they'll start writing right away and they'll hope what they have at the end is, you know, something that's something that makes sense. But I said, you don't start with a conclusion, right? You don't start with a thesis. You have to build up to the top of the pyramid. And I have talked about this on the show before. So a lot of that is skipped, but we do review it a little bit in this class. And most of the time was put towards me helping them through what we'll call the idea generation process, right? Because I happen to know a lot about the purpose of education, and I usually don't go into this stuff in this much detail in the class, but I kind of got on a roll, and some of these groups are pretty chatty and some of these groups are pretty quiet. There was not as much discussion as I hoped for with these guys, so I unfortunately do most of the talking. And I do have a couple corrections to make when I go back to teach the third session of this class this coming Saturday. In the previous week, we had dealt with another essay prompt, another question, and that question was, is conscience a more powerful motivator than money, fame, and power? And you'll hear me say that history does not suggest that conscience is a more powerful motivator of human beings than money, fame, and power. But of course, I'm not talking about all human beings, and I really didn't clarify that, so I'll make sure I do that when I go back. Most of the people, almost everybody who's ever lived, we have no historical record of their lives. The only historical records we have, and the further you go back, the more true this becomes, of people from the past is political and religious leaders. Most of those people are pretty creepy, and I think it's really true that very few of them, if any, were motivated more by conscience, if motivated by conscience at all, than money, fame, power, legacy, you know, their own sort of narcissistic self-aggrandizement. But I don't want that to be representative of everybody who ever lived. But I feel like, from what I see, most people are more motivated as far as their daily choices are concerned by a sense of right and wrong. And I'm really very confident that history backs that up. I've said on the show before that evil intentions, or people with intentions that might be considered evil or destructive, the lust for power, the intentions of those people have been able to catch a ride on the good intentions of others all throughout time. You know, the most powerful weapon that these people who are hungry for more control have been able to wield is the good intentions of ordinary people. This is right, this is just, this is moral, this makes you good to do this thing that we say. Right? And then that's wrapped up in all of this religious doctrine, the idea of nationalism, patriotism, family. We see how this works. And, you know, no one ever said, I mean, none of these people who are, who have been, you know, labeled evil by history, Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, Mao, they didn't get stuff done by saying, let's see how evil we can be. They said, this is right, this is just, let's see how good we can be. And it sounds crazy, but I mean, that's pretty much, you know, in a nutshell, that's how it went down. There were a couple other errors as well that I think need to be cleared up. We get into, in this education question and in the conscience question, the name Hitler was thrown around a couple of times. There are these people, because a lot of these SAT essay questions are these ethical issues. We sort of sort famous people into the categories of good and bad and write about them. And, you know, the standard good guys of history are people like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Gandhi. A lot of people will say Jesus or Mother Teresa, even though Mother Teresa was probably crazy and not really motivated by, a desire to actually help people, but she probably thought she was, you know, serving something else. I know there's more to the story than just some woman who gave her whole life to help lepers. So, and then, you know, the bads, Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin. I would add a lot more names to that list, but those are usually the ones that students generate. My list includes Abraham Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, George Bush. Nobody ever says those names, but we're talking about Hitler. And at one point, I say that Hitler came to power through democratic means. This is actually not true. Hitler was appointed in the early 1930s by the person who was the president of the Weimar Republic as the chancellor. Now, it is true that the conditions were such in the Weimar Republic that Hitler was probably able to get into this position, and then his ascension power began because of things that had happened through a democratic process. In 1932, the Nazi Party, which probably looked a lot different in 1932, obviously, than it did in 1942, was able to gain majority control of the Reich through voting. I think they had almost 40% of what would essentially be the legislature, of the seats in the legislature. 40%, almost 40% was controlled by the Nazi Party after the 1932 election. So Hitler, who was a member of the Nazi Party, was certainly able to get a lot of stuff done by having the majority support in the democratically elected government in Germany. And even though I got that little fact wrong, I think the basic thrust of the argument I was trying to make still stands, that it was the people, you know, the people's acceptance of somebody like Hitler through, you know, made possible through generation after generation of this Prussian education system where, you know, authority is truth. That's what made the Third Reich and all of its horrors possible, in my opinion. And I think that's verifiable. If you look at how just every step of, you know, the power grab process, Hitler was cheered on by the public, especially after the Reichstag fire there. Now, I said something else that I think is a little bit more important. I said Hitler was not that impressive of a guy. I think one time I say he was not that smart. I don't know how smart he was. I probably shouldn't have said that. And I, like I said, I'll make sure all this stuff is corrected next week, that I go over this with the people in the class. I said, so Hitler was somebody who rode a wave of bad ideas into power. Now, certainly, some philosophies have been so dangerous, some ideas have been so bad and potentially destructive that you could not even, were ultimately destructive, that you could not even calculate their impact, like in the equivalence of detonated nuclear weapons. I mean, bad or dangerous ideas have killed so many people on this planet in the last couple hundred years, you know, or acting on those ideas. But there's also another thing that we have to think about is misinterpretation of philosophy, especially people like Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and Hegel, who were all very influential in most of Europe. You know, even though they were gone, I think Nietzsche died in the year 1900, even though they were gone, their ideas carried on. And sometimes I think that they were deliberately misinterpreted by people like Hitler, by people like Mussolini, who wanted to use them as justifications for the things that they were doing. Sometimes we talk about these state intellectuals who have to find the rationalizations in the moment to back up all of the sick shit that the people in power want to do. But this is a little bit different. I think the fascism, the communism, these ideas that really take hold in the 20th century and are really so destructive and kill so many millions of people were, in many cases, misinterpretations and sometimes intentional misinterpretations of the writings of people like Nietzsche and Hegel. Now, I'm not sure. I mean, Nietzsche, as far as I'm concerned, had some pretty bizarre and sick things to say. You know, I mean, he was in favor of slavery. He was in favor of the subjugation of women. He saw the very idea of morality as kind of this, you know, this limitation on the greatness of the Superman. This gets into Hegel as well, who said that most people are not that special and most people are just kind of like the playthings of history. But it's this, you know, this one great man who can come along and, you know, reshape the world. And, I think, you know, Napoleon would be one of those figures, that other people were just sort of props in that process, right? That their lives didn't matter because they were, you know, the playthings of, this great mind, this great dynamic figure, this Superman. That was an idea that Nietzsche put forward, of the, you know, the human being is something to be surpassed. Of course, now we start looking at the misinterpretations. Hitler would, from what I remember reading, credited Nietzsche as his all-time favorite philosopher. But, I mean, that doesn't immediately make Nietzsche, everything that Nietzsche wrote, invalid or evil. I mean, George Bush's favorite philosopher is Jesus Christ. Jesus never wanted to hurt anybody. And, you know, assuming that there was a real guy called Jesus and that was his philosophy, I would say it's pretty sound. You know, I mean, when you kind of subtract all of the other stuff from the story, like bushes that talk and monkeys that fly, and actually monkeys that fly, that might have been another, that might have been something else. But, yeah, when you get rid of all that crap and you're just left with, okay, maybe there was a man who said these things, yeah, that's like a decent philosophy. George Bush is responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths of innocent people. So just to, you know, use a more modern example. But just for a moment, just to make sure we're clear, to jump back to some of these other thinkers like Hegel and Nietzsche, some of the ideas that they put forward, you know, might not have been awful. And in many cases, and you know, like I said, you know, Nietzsche wrote some pretty twisted things about slavery and women, but a lot of the things that he wrote might have merely been observations about the world in which he lived. The will to power, the idea of the primacy of the will. You know, if you look at the world that Nietzsche observed in the 19th century, it's filled with domination systems. You know, religion, probably a little bit more rigid structure for the family as a result of religion, as a result of a lot of the states and kingdoms and empires that these people lived in, slavery. And, you know, Nietzsche's assessment was, well, this is how it is, and what you have to do is be victorious. You have to be at the top of the domination system. Now, I don't know if that was a call to go be at the top of a domination system, but that was certainly the way that people like Mussolini and Hitler interpreted this idea of the will to power, that the will is what counts. The conquerors must be superior to their victims because, after all, they're the conquerors. I never read anything by Nietzsche that suggested that he was in favor of people going out and doing violence. But he certainly was in favor of this idea of the strong, the will of the strong, dominating the weak. And that leaves a lot of room for interpretation in later years by some people who were far more twisted than he was. But we still see plenty of that in our culture today, in the 21st century, you know, in our political system. People want to be at the top of what they know to be a domination system. Politics, this great tool that makes, you know, controlling and exploiting and violating your enemies look civilized. I think those are very, very similar ideas. The Superman idea, Hegel's world historical individuals, again, might have just been an observation that some people can rise to what they would have defined as greatness, which is, you know, political power and control, especially Hegel. I mean, if you look at the people that he would say are heroic, they were all these, you know, dictators, maniacs, who just seized a bunch of power. But, yeah, I mean, some people are more capable of achievement than others. I think a lot of it might have to do with the fact that if, you know, this achievement is power, those people might be more unwell than most others. But both Hegel and Nietzsche put this idea forward of the Superman. You know, man is something to be surpassed. But those men were few and far between. So when one of them came along, almost everybody else was just relegated to this subservience, to this awe and obedience. Again, we see where that went in the 20th century. Nietzsche once wrote, perhaps as an observation, but, you know, I mean, when you read this, it sounds pretty twisted. The misfortunes of small folk do not count for anything except in the feelings of men of might. Now, if the interpretations hadn't turned out to be so horrifying, the irony here would be almost amusing. Nietzsche was a critic of the state. So when he said something, and I'm paraphrasing, like morality is a recipe against the passions, he's talking about the kind of state-imposed moralities. And when he's talking about, you know, men of might, he's talking about people who have struggled to overcome something. He's not talking about Hitler, right? I think if a lot of these people, I would even throw in friggin' Karl Marx, could be reanimated to look back at the results of their ideas, they would be utterly horrified. Some of them might not be. And it might even be more complex than that. Nietzsche might look at some of the things that happened and be like, yeah, that's cool. And some other things and be like, oh, that's terrible. And I really don't know, you know, but like the point I'm trying to make is it's the ride that these power hungry people can take, not only on the good intentions of others, but also on the ideas. But this Superman thing, can you see how an idea like this, if misunderstood, maybe understood correctly, I mean, I don't know what Nietzsche's intentions were when he wrote that, can lead to a culture of hero worship? I think the culture that these guys lived in, you know, they certainly worshipped heroes in the 19th century, but nothing like the 20th century, where these cults of personality developed around these mentally unstable and unhealthy figures. But they are heroic because they had that will to power. They were these world historical individuals. And you can see, just from titles of things, how conscious the managers of public opinion in the Third Reich were of this idea. Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, My Struggle, the famous propaganda film, The Triumph of the Will. And like I said, these ideas continue right up to the present day. You look at the faith of ordinary people in somebody like Obama. You know, what people had in George Bush after September 11th, that everybody gravitates to the shins of these people who claim that, you know, they have the answers and they have the way. Danger, danger, danger.
Foremost, you're trying to persuade the person who's reading it an issue that usually has two sides. Sometimes the questions could be open-ended, but it's usually one way or the other, right? It's usually yes or no. What's the question on your test?
Is the purpose of education to change the world?
Yes or no. Is the purpose of education to change the world? It's a yes or no question, right? Now, obviously, yes and no as responses will not be sufficient, but it is this way or that way. So you have to pick a side on that issue and, you know, write about it. So let's take that one. Is the purpose of education to change the world? So we had to think about what do we know? What are our...
You want to say of course, but then... Again, it doesn't always seem that way. Change the world, or change
the world's pretty broad, right? That's a pretty vague.
Like anything can change the world, I guess.
Right, and it doesn't say whether the purpose is to change the world for the better or for the worse. So when we think about that question, where would we, like, say we go in, we sit down to take the test, and that's the question that we get. Now, like I said, one of the things that people do a lot that I find is they start writing something immediately. They feel like they have 25 minutes, so they're going to start writing an essay immediately. And like I said, I really don't recommend this approach because you can wind up writing yourself into a corner where you say, I know what to do. Like, what was the question we did last week? Is conscience a more powerful motivator than money, fame, and power? And we say, yes, of course, conscience, yes, which is, you know, I think is the right answer, or the way it should be. Unfortunately, history does not provide us too many examples of people who were clearly motivated by conscience more than money, fame, power, some kind of legacy for themselves. So, you know, it might require you to pause for a couple minutes. And if you haven't written anything for 5 minutes, because you're planning or you're trying to draw, I mean, the more you think about what you know, the more you realize that you know, right? Like when you first read one of these questions, you might be like, oh, I don't know what I would write for this. So really in the first minute, I would, like, being creative and being organizational are two different processes. So what winds up happening a lot on these essays that I've read is people have these very imaginative ideas, but they're not very well organized, or they just have these very bland five-paragraph essays that are not very interesting, sort of like stock responses to these questions. Now, on that question, is conscience a more powerful motivator than money, fame, and power? We did produce a list of people that seemed to be motivated more than others by their conscience, and they were like standard people, you know, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks. All of the good examples of people who seem to be motivated by conscience are all people we shouldn't write about because everybody writes about them. Because so many of these essays are like, take a position on an ethical issue. It always becomes about good and bad, right? So these people are good, these people are bad. I said, who's the number one archetypal bad person in all of history? Hitler. That's what everyone says. Now, whether that's really true, I mean, were there people worse who did worse things, who had worse effect? You know, I mean, you could say Alexander the Great might have been worse than Hitler. But, I mean, as far as, like, the death toll of innocent people is concerned, we don't know. But, I mean, Hitler is usually the first that comes to mind, right? So I want to stay away from people like that. And in that question of, is conscience a more powerful motivator than money, fame, or power, starting the essay like, it would be nice if we could say that historically conscience was more of a motivator than money, fame, and power. But, unfortunately, history proves that the opposite is true. Right, so you've said, okay, I know what the right answer should be, but unfortunately the evidence goes this way. Now, what about that question? Is the purpose of education to change the world? So now we have to start, like, if the clock starts ticking now, the first thing that we should try to do in a minute is generate as much ideas as we can about that question, or what we know about education, what we think about education, what we feel about education. All of you guys are in school, so, I mean,
say, yeah, and just use both bad and good examples.
You could do that. I don't see a problem with that, right? Because you could say that the purpose of education has been to change the world, but in good and bad ways. So what are some good ways that we would say? I like that, because that gives you, you're answering the question in the affirmative, right? You're saying yes, but now you're kind of like, you're leaving it open enough where you could deal with some good things about education and some bad things about education. So what are some good things? I mean, what are some good ways that education can change the world, or has?
It improves literacy rate.
I would say that a higher literacy rate
allows people to understand what's going on around them and participate in the government or society.
Participate in society. I like that. Who knows what the feudal system is? Feudal system, a few of you have studied that in school. Feudal system was a period lasted in Europe. I'm not sure how many centuries it actually lasted, but this was serfs, right? People who were basically born on some kind of a manor run by a lord. They did farm labor. These people were not educated. You know, there was no access. I mean, a lot of the feudal system, I think, was even before movable type, so there was not access to a lot of books.
It was in Russia until like 1700s.
It exists in different pockets in Europe, and Eastern Europe, in varying degrees. You know, from Britain to what is considered Russia, or what eventually became Russia. I would say the 12th century, maybe in some places up until the 18th century. I'm not really sure of the dates. I used to teach history, and I found that you know, history is not really about dates. So you'll have to, you know, like, you think it is, right? Like, when you study for history tests, but it's more about ideas than memorizing a bunch of dates. But so we have this system where these people are raised on these farms, and they can't be educated, because if they're educated, if they could read, they would start being like, what the hell is going on here, right? Like, maybe they go to the Lord, and they say, you know, I noticed that, you know, you sit up there on your porch all day, and you look comfortable, and, you know, I do like 18 hours of farm labor, and then I go and sleep in a dirt floor shack with two sheep, and I'm wondering, you know, why our lives are so different like this. And maybe the Lord's answer would be like, well, you know, God has a plan for all of us. So we don't want to make them upset by questioning the plan, you know. And I mean, that's what you get when people aren't educated. And the lack of education, the lack of, you know, literacy, which you said, which is a good example, was used to control people for thousands of years. It was illegal to teach slaves in this country how to read and write, because exactly the same thing would have happened. They would have said, what kind? I mean, you think about it, when you're born into slavery, you don't know that you're a slave. That's just your life. Harriet Tubman was another person that we talked about as one of those sort of archetypal good guys from history, right? And she had this quote, I freed thousands of slaves, and I could have freed thousands more if they had known that they were slaves. Because, like, maybe the people who were running this Underground Railroad would come to them, and they would say, no, there's, you know, there's something better out there. There's, what are you talking about? We get a shelter, get, like, two meals a day, we get stuff to do while we're not eating or sleeping. I mean, like, what are you talking about? What do you guys do? You go run around in the woods? You go run away from slave catchers? That sounds like a good time, right? So, yeah, exactly. You get whipped if you get caught. I mean, what are you, crazy? Right. So, because they weren't educated, they could not even see, you know, the world. So, obviously, in that sense, education changed the world in a very, very positive way. What else? Education changing the world in a positive way. Obviously, like the first idea we could sum up, and that's a good paragraph right there, it freed a lot of people from what we would essentially call slavery or serfdom, right? The more they understood about the world, the more they questioned it, obviously. And when you start asking questions, when you start questioning systems that are sort of just propped up by fear and mythology, they usually collapse, you know, pretty quickly, if not within a century or a couple generations. So yes, that is certainly a way that education has changed the world for the better. What else? Any others?
Well, it kind of like readies children to go out and in the future change the world, I guess.
So education is preparation for adulthood. You know, another thing that I agree that it can be, and I agree that in many ways, it has been. But I think one of the most important things to do, and this will also give you a little bit more flexibility if this is the essay that you were given to write in this, you know, when you go to take the test, is education is a word that it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, right? Like, to me, education doesn't mean, you know, sitting in classrooms for 35 hours a week with somebody at the front of the room. And even though that's kind of what we have going on here in this SAT class, but you know, it doesn't mean basically sitting quietly while, you know, somebody at the front of the room tells you what to do and tells you what's important. It's you know, it's a lifelong process, and it's about you know, the individual and your own explorations, and not so much about being fed worksheets to fill out, right? Because in that way, like, it does have some things about it do prepare us for adult society, like fill out this paperwork, right? Like, you guys probably all have your driver's license. Anyone have their own car? Okay, so you're starting to realize that there's some paperwork out there. There's more. There's more than that. But yeah, I mean, so, and I'm like, you know, I don't want to knock on school too much, but school does really, I found, and I do a lot of college consulting, it narrows people into this kind of thinking, all right, well, there's really only this one path, I have
so
to go to college. Yeah.
Or other thinking.
It kind of restricts other thinking. It kind of puts our thinking, I really believe that it does do that. You know, there are positive aspects about education for changing the world, right? Because it, you know, prepares us maybe, depending on how we define education, to deal with our emotions, to become responsible, to develop a good work ethic. But to me, that doesn't mean schooling. Like, that's something else, right? Now, schooling has traditionally been used for not really good reasons, right? Like, making people go to school has where did they try that? Well, I mean, anybody else? Any other thoughts before I tell a story? I mean, what does anyone think of a negative?
The restriction of thinking. I use ideas. I use like child soldiers. They teach them, like, just kill or be killed.
Right, right. There was a kingdom in Europe in the throughout the 19th century, probably existed before that in the 18th century, called Prussia. You guys might have learned about Prussia in school. Prussia was, they wanted to build an empire, like everybody did in Europe. And that's why we have, you know, these wars in Europe where they had these little states, and they just say, oh, well, let's, you know, let's get some more land. And then they all are just, like, growing, and then they start bumping into each other, and then they have to fight each other, and, you know, and then one of them contracts, and one of them grows, and that's just kind of how Europe, I mean, it's, you know, it's reached kind of a relative peace now, but that's how Europe was for, you know, centuries. So Prussia is a kingdom, like maybe the 1820s, 1830s, and they decide that there's this problem. They do conscript these people into the army. They do force these people to go and fight for them, right, to put on these uniforms and go and do the king's killing in an effort to expand their land. But what most people do when they find themselves in these battles, they're like, what am I doing here? I'm going to get killed. So they throw whatever weapon they have and they run away, which is the only rational thing to do, really, when someone's shooting at you, and you don't know why you're there. So they start to come up with a story. They go back to the drawing board, their intellectual community and their leadership in Prussia. They start trying to make, like, an identity for the kingdom, or that there's something special about the kingdom, that it's a noble cause to fight for Prussia. Right? So this is like 1830s. The system runs through, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 generations. What is the land of Prussia by 1930?
Germany.
Right? Where 4 or 5 generations, people have been taught this myth that they are some kind of superior, that they are just naturally superior people, that they have some kind of unique culture that's worth exporting to other places. They've been trained essentially to worship authority. Winston Churchill said one time that the Germans are either they're either at your feet or they're at your throat. They basically obey your leaders and attack who your leaders say, right? At your feet or at your throat. And they basically created an education system that allowed them to just have a reliable sort of servile labor force and, you know, a steady supply of foot soldiers. And that changed the world in a bad way. You know, everyone agrees that what happened in Germany in the 1930s and the 1940s was bad. So that's plenty of a material for that essay, I think. Anybody else have any other ideas? Now, some of that education system, you know, parts of it were borrowed for the education system that we've had in this country really since the 1880s and 1890s, which was originally very much about putting people into factories, right? Because they needed people who could run factory machines, right? Now, a factory job is not awesome. Like, you kind of sit there, work these incredibly long days, and people needed to be trained for this. So originally, school in America was just about, like, can you sit still, can you follow simple directions, and can you do basically the same thing over and over again? And it was maybe 8 years. Maybe in 8th grade, you were out. You were ready to go to work. I mean, 8th grade, what are you, 13, 14? You were ready to go to work. So, I mean, 120 years ago, they did borrow from the Prussian system for the original system in this country. Now, of course, we can see how education as an idea, or education as a more broad, open concept, has changed the world in very positive ways. What has usually changed the world in more negative ways has been some form of forced schooling, where the only way the Prussian system worked was because they made everybody go. They made everybody go to these schools. And they even in Prussia, they had one, they called it the Volksschule, which, like, Volkswagen is, Volks means people. Like, it becomes folks in English. But that was for the people. It was called the people's school. And then they had a school called the Realschule. And I'm not good with the German pronunciation. And I was talking about this once before, and someone corrected my pronunciation. They made fun of it. They're like, how bad my German pronunciation was. But the Realschule, which means, guess what? The real school. Where they sent, like, you know, the children of the leadership and the elites and the rich people. And they, okay, this is how you manage the people who go to the Volksschule. And that was pretty much, that was, you know, that was their system. That was their culture. And we see how that seed of, like, let's just get people who put these uniforms on and keep marching forward and not run away. And people who will be good employees as, you know, as they became more industrial. That seed grew into this incredible tree of evil, the Third Reich. Well, I mean, Hitler, we talked about as this bad guy, right? Like the Darth Vader of history. Hitler was not that impressive of a guy. He was not that smart of a guy. He was just somebody who was able to ride a wave of bad ideas into power, you know? Through movies, right, we think of bad guys as like these diabolical villains. Hitler was not that. He was just an unimpressive guy who was in the right place at the right time, you know? And that's important. But schooling in that country made it possible for somebody like him, for people put into a position to say, yeah, I'd like someone like that to be my leader, you know? To have that little willingness to question authority. Like, oh, this guy can give a good speech? Great. Where do I vote? And Hitler didn't seize power. I mean, he did eventually, once he was in power, figure out ways to get more of it, as, you know, most people throughout history in power have done. But they elected that guy. By popular demand. Hitler, you know? So I think that's an important thing to point out. But I think we fleshed that essay out pretty well. Does anyone else have any questions about the essay? My point was, you see how much information we can generate just by talking about something a little longer than I wanted to, and that's a process that you have to condense into, like, 4 or 5 minutes, obviously. But just thinking about what you know about a subject can really help you get a lot on paper. And then that's the creative process, idea generation. And once you do idea generation, then you can organize it. You don't want to be trying to create and organize at the same time, because then you wind up with a mess. You know, this is the whole right brain, left brain thing. Like, you know, fire this one first as far as getting some ideas generated from what you already know, and then worry about how to put them in some kind of comprehensible order so you can write a 5-paragraph essay about it. But that, I mean, that can happen in 5 to 7 minutes. And if you plan, you know, if you generate ideas and then you organize them well, 18 minutes, if you have 18 minutes left, that's plenty of time to write a good essay. I would try to save 2 or 3 minutes at the end, because we also have this language problem when we write or talk fast. We tend to use words like good. What's good? I always ask this question, and everyone looks at me like I'm crazy, but what does the word good mean? Yeah. It means not bad. What does bad mean? Not good. Right? So, like, world peace is good, but so is ice cream. Right, so good is a word that basically describes nothing. So we tend to use, when we write quickly, we tend to use a lot of abstract language, like words that don't mean anything. They don't have any power, right? Good has no power as a word. There's a lot of words that we could make more concrete. So if you find yourself using a lot of words that don't really have any power, that don't really have any descriptive power, make sure you go back and try to replace them with a better. I mean, they're usually adjectives, but they could be verbs, you know, like did. It's a verb that could probably be replaced with something better, something that's more concrete, more descriptive. So if you have 2 minutes to go back and do that at the end, that's also helpful. But, I mean, the most important thing is that you are trying to persuade somebody, so start with facts and build your way up to the opinion. Like, you can say, all right, yes or no on most of these yes or no questions, but then you have to start thinking about the yes or no is the opinion at that capstone of the pyramid, but you have to have that whole structure underneath it. So you have to say to yourself, can I build... I can't just have this little, you know, top of a pyramid wobbling around in the air. That never works. You need to make sure you can build it up from underneath. And that's why I say it's okay to take those 5 minutes at the beginning to generate ideas. If you have an opinion, like we have these sayings, like everybody's entitled to their opinion. And I guess, yeah, I mean, anybody should be able to think whatever they want or say whatever they want without, you know, getting punched for it. Or worse, you know, in a lot of places, maybe it's worse what happens to people. But it doesn't mean that they have to be taken seriously. It's not like, I'm entitled to my opinion, I'm entitled to be taken seriously. Why? You know, what's your opinion based on? You know? Well, you're not. If you have an opinion and you can back it up, then yeah, we should be taking people seriously. And it's the same thing with this. You are trying to persuade somebody on one side of an issue. So make sure you can do that. And start with facts. Start with things. It doesn't have to be like, you know, obviously you can't bring anything with you, so it's not like lists of statistics and stuff. But start with facts and say, all right, what do I know? Go into, you know, your own reservoir of knowledge and say, all right, I learned about this in history, or I read this book, or I've had this experience, right? Because no one's going to argue with you about your own experiences. No one's going to read your essay and be like, he's making that up. Always better if it's your own experience, right? If you can talk about your own experience. Because no one can argue with you about you.
I call you out.
Right.
No. You did not do that.
Well, like the person who's reading it's going to find you. Like they're going to go to your registration form and be like, you lied in your essay. And that just didn't happen.
Call it BS, right?
Right, right. Exactly. So make sure that you take the time to be sure that you can prove, not prove, but make a very, very convincing argument for your opinion on an issue one way or the other. Any other questions? Awesome.